Welcome to Grace Point Church. My name is Alan. I'm the junior high pastor here. And in the summertime, the way our teaching schedule works is you guys get a chance to hear from myself. Last week, you guys had a chance to hear from Brent Oglesby, the high school pastor. But yeah, you get an opportunity to just to hear from some of the different teachers and the different staff here at Grace Point. And this morning, I have the privilege of teaching with you. And I just wanted to give you a little bit of information about myself or just kind of tell you about junior high. I've been working with students for about the past it's been over 10 years now, and I love it. I've had the opportunity to work with college students, with high school students, and when I started out, I was started out with junior high students, and now that's kind of where I've ended up back again. And I just want to say there's a reason for that. I love junior high students. I love that time of life. We get to eat a lot of pizza and watch a lot of movies and play laser tag. But more importantly, it's a time in life where students begin to develop their own faith, where they're starting to learn more. It's a time of life where they're growing up a lot and they're asking a lot of questions and just kind of trying to figure out who God is. And so I get the chance to work with them and to basically, talk to them about who Christ is in their life and what it means to follow him. And I love it because it's just this pivotal moment in their life where they're deciding what their faith is and kind of making it their own. And so I love it. So like I said, last week, Brent spoke. We've been going through a series on urban legends and kind of debunking these myths that we have about some like Christian sayings, things we say. Last week, Brent talked about, this idea, can faith fix anything? He kind of broke that down and talked about how God fixes things. It's not necessarily the level of our faith, but it's God who does that. And this morning, we're looking at another one of those urban legends. And before we get into it, I kind of want to just talk about sort of a first impression I had when I came to the passage. And I realized this very quickly, and this is obvious, but there are good stories and there are bad stories. And I'll tell you which this passage is in a second. But what I want to do first is show you guys just three quick movie clips that kind of demonstrate sort of the very stark difference between these things. This first clip that I want to show you guys, it's from one of my favorite movies, one of my favorite stories, and that's The Lord of the Rings. And I love this story as a whole. I feel like it's a really dynamic story. You've got these moments where you have characters who are struggling. They're trying to destroy the ring, and you've got these moments where hope seems to be lost, and then it comes back, and it's just this awesome epic story, and I love it, and I love it because it's really dynamic. Let's go ahead and show this first clip. All right. I don't know about you, but I watched that and even just now I'm like, oh, I actually just want to watch the rest of this movie. Can we just do that right now instead? But I love it. It pulls you in, just the music, all of that and everything. It's like this moment where Gandalf, I think most of you are probably familiar with the story, but he's their leader. He's their one kind of rock, their hope. And in the scene he falls. And so their hope just seems to be crushed. And then this next clip is just the part where he comes back. Let's go ahead and play that real quick.
Show yourself.
All right. And so kind of the point there, and I love it, is this moment, you've got this moment of tragedy in at the end of the second movie where Gandalf falls and then he comes back. And later on in this movie, you see Gandalf be pivotal in leading them to victory. And he's, you know, their hope kind of restored and comes back. And so you've got this moment where you're just like, oh man, like this is bad. And then you've got this moment where Gandalf comes back. And, you know, shortly after this, they're riding with him and they're fighting. And, you know, it's a great story and I love it. Now, I've got one more clip to show you, and this is an example of kind of another type of story. Let's go ahead and play this.
Tonight we'll hear the story of Crispy Bear. A long time ago, this little bear was alive because she listened to her father, so she was happy. But Crispy had one terrible problem. She was filled with curiosity. Yes. And one day, she saw something new and died.
Like that?
Yes.
Oh, same endings every day.
I get it, Dad. I would never do anything new or different.
Good man, Bunk.
All right. So kind of funny, but not actually a great story. If you haven't seen that movie, The Croods, it's pretty hilarious. But not a great story. It's just, okay, there was this bear and this bear died. Like, wow, okay. The story we're coming to today, and if you want to go ahead and turn there, if you don't have a Bible, go ahead and grab one. We're going to be looking at 1 Samuel chapter 4. 1 Samuel chapter 4. And we'll see that this story is more in line with that clip that you just saw. And it's kind of, at first glance, just it seems kind of like a defeatist story. It seems like a tragedy. While you're turning there to 1 Samuel 4, I want to just give you some background on when this takes place. A lot of times when you go through the Old Testament and you read stories about Israel, it's hard to realize, okay, well, where in time are they? What's going on? And in this passage, Israel has already been delivered from Egypt. They've spent time in the wilderness, and God has brought them into the Promised Land. In fact, it's been over 200 years since Israel was brought into the Promised Land, and they're doing well. They're getting set up, and in fact, they're probably pretty comfortable. But what happens in the situation is that Israel is going to war against the Philistines. You remember the Philistines, Goliath, David and Goliath. Goliath was a Philistine. And basically, they're like a notorious enemy of Israel. And the reason for this is because they were one of the people that were inhabiting the Promised Land that was given to Israel before they were there. So there's this conflict for the land that Israel is constantly fighting with the Philistines. And so they're in a battle here. And let's go ahead and read this passage together. It's 1 Samuel 4, verses 1 through 11. I'll go ahead and read this. And the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines. They encamped at Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped at Aphek. The Philistines drew up in line against Israel, and when the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the battlefield. And when the people came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies." So the people sent to Shiloh and brought from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of hosts, who is enthroned on the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. As soon as the Ark of the Covenant came into the camp, all Israel gave a mighty shout so that the earth resounded. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shouting, they said, "What does this great shouting in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" And when they learned that the Ark of the Lord had come to the camp, the Philistines were afraid. For they said, "A God has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us. Who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been to you. Be men and fight." And then verse 10. So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and they fled, every man to his home. And there was a very great slaughter, for 30,000 foot soldiers of Israel fell. And the Ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. So that's our passage for today. And again, as I read it, I was like, this is an interesting story. We have this battle. Israel goes up against the Philistines and they're defeated. And it feels like that moment maybe where we saw Gandalf fall. It feels like the moment of, okay, well, things got bad. Like, this isn't great. But then they have this plan. They're like, you know what? We're going to go get the Ark of the Covenant. We're going to go bring God's presence, and then we're going to destroy them. In fact, they're cheering. They're excited. Everyone's fired up. And then they take the Ark into battle. And what happens is this, is instead of them having this mighty victory, instead of only 4,000 people dying, you have 30,000 soldiers being slaughtered and the Ark of the Covenant, God's presence before the people being captured. So it's this really defeatist story. You read it and you're like, wow, okay, so they go out, they try to, you know, capture the Ark, or they try to fight and they bring the Ark and they lose again. Like, this isn't working out. And that's what we're talking about this morning, is this idea of God brings good luck. That's one of the urban legends that we have, is this idea of, okay, well, you know what? Like, if I'm doing the right things, if I have God on my side, then I'm going to have good luck. I'm going to be lucky. And that's what we're going to be looking at today. But here, looking at this passage, what's the problem? Why did God's people lose in the first place? You know, they're God's people, they're fighting the Philistines. They should be the ones winning because they're God's people. And the second question that I have is why didn't the ark work also? Like, that should have saved them. And I want to talk about that. I want to talk about why for the people they would think, you know, hey, let's go grab the ark. At first when I read it, I was like, okay, maybe them grabbing the ark, maybe that was sinful. Maybe this is a sacred object that shouldn't be out in war. I don't know. But when you look at it, when you look at it historically, the Ark of the Covenant was usually present during battles that Israel fought and won and did well in, and in miraculous situations that God delivered his people. And I want to look at a couple of those. And this morning, if you didn't grab a Bible, I would again encourage you to grab one, because we're going to be going through kind of a lot of scripture looking at right now just what, like how the ark was used in different situations. And the first one is this, is the fall of Jericho. You guys are probably familiar with this story, but I'm going to read Joshua 6, 2 through 5. You can turn there if you want or just listen, but this is what it says. Joshua 6, 2 through 5. And the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city, all the men of war, going around the city once. Thus shall you do for 6 days. Seven priests shall bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. On the seventh day, you shall march around the city seven times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, then all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up, everyone straight before him." And it's a classic story. It's a Sunday school story. You guys know it. That's what Joshua was told to do by the Lord, was to go and walk around this city. And on the seventh day, blow these trumpets, yell, and the walls would fall down. And that's what happens. If you continue on the story, that's exactly how it goes. And the people in the situation, they had the ark with them. The trumpets were going before the ark. There's another situation in Numbers 10:33 where the Lord goes before them, where Moses is leading the people in the wilderness. And it says, "So that they set out from the mountain of the Lord and traveled for 3 days. The Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them during these 3 days to find them a place to rest. The cloud of the Lord was over them by day and when they set out from the camp." And so just kind of this idea that the people, as they're going through the wilderness, that the Ark is going before them as God's presence is going before them. So again, the Ark is a very significant thing for the people of Israel. And we'll see later on, we're going to actually refer to this story later, but there's the situation where Joshua is leading Israel across the Jordan. And what they do is basically the priests take the Ark and they step into the Jordan. And as soon as they step into the waters part, and basically the water is stopped up and all of Israel crosses on dry ground. And so the point that I want to make here is that the ark is significant. It's not just that the people were foolish and saying, "Hey, let's go grab the ark." In fact, when I look at these stories and when I look at Israel's history, I'm like, you know what? Actually, like, they lost. They went and got the ark. That seems like the smart thing to do, and it seems like it should have worked, but it didn't. And I want to make that clear, though, is that the ark is something that is valuable, and historically, the people have seen deliverance through the ark. And so it's not necessarily the reason why I think that they lost. Let's go ahead and continue, and I want to look at reasons of why, you know, this didn't work out for them, why it didn't bring them good luck. And the first point is that the Israelites are not walking with God. And what I want to say is that context matters. You'll hear Bob and Dave, when they teach, talk about, hey, it's important, you know, that you understand the context of this passage. In fact, when you read any good story, if you were to just read a little snippet from the middle of it and be like, oh yeah, I understand that, or I understand what's going on here, you'd be wrong. Like, you can read a story, and unless you know, like, from the start to finish, how it begins and how it ends, if you just pick something in the middle and just read that out of context, you won't get an understanding of what's going on there. And actually, something that kind of, this is sort of a side note, but something that made this really clear for me is a couple weeks ago, we were with the high schoolers up at Hume Lake at this summer camp, and we were out on this boat, and I was out on a boat with some students, and one of the girls stands up and goes, "Look, see, they look like piggies." And she points at this mom and her two daughters who are in this boat, and like, I see the mom's face drop. She's like, how dare you? Those are my kids. Like, it was this really awkward moment. And I was like, oh my gosh, what have you done? And what the lady didn't understand, and she apologized later, but what the lady didn't understand is before this, like 15 minutes earlier, the student had said, look at these stumps in the lake. They kind of look like pigs. And so she, the lady who was in the boat, hadn't heard that part of the story. But it was this moment where just because the context wasn't there, this person was offended. And again, they ended up apologizing. It was fine. But it's critical for us to understand context. And so that's what I want to do, is to answer this question of and show that the Israelites are not walking with God. We need to look at some of the surrounding passages and look at kind of the state of Israel before going into this war. The first passage I want to look at, it's 1 Samuel 2, verse 23. And I'll give you a second to turn there. But this is the story, or this is referring to the priest Eli and his two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. And it's just kind of a description about what he says to them based on what they've done. So 1 Samuel 2, starting in verse 23. So he said to them, why do you do such things? I hear from all the people about these wicked deeds of yours. No, my sons, the report I hear spreading among the Lord's people is not good. If one person sins against another, God may mediate for the offender. But if anyone sins against the Lord, who will intercede for them? His sons, however, did not listen to their father's rebuke. Now, these people, as we read in the story, they are actually the ones who brought forth the ark to battle. They're the people who are entrusted with the ark. And if you look at more of the context, we don't have time to read the whole story today, but basically these two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, they were abusing their authority over the ark. They were abusing their authority to allow people into the temple. They were committing basically terrible deeds that were not pleasing before the sight of the Lord. And then if you look further after the story, 1 Samuel 7, I'll give you a second to turn there as well. 1 Samuel 7, 3. We see that Israel at the time was actually worshiping idols and serving other gods. 1 Samuel 7, 3 says this. Then all the people of Israel turned back to the Lord. So Samuel said to all the Israelites, if you are returning to the Lord with all your hearts, then rid yourselves of the foreign gods and Ashtoreths and commit yourselves to the Lord and serve him only. And he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. And then it goes on to basically describe how Israel removed these idols from amongst their midst. And it's something that if you didn't read this section, if you just read the story of the battle, you're like, wait, God is just being brutal to these people. Why is he allowing them to be slaughtered? They're bringing the ark. What's going on here? But when you read this and you see later on, you're like, no, their hearts were far from God. They were not seeking after God. So what we see from the context is that at the time, Israel had become a sinful nation. And this brings us to our next point. The Israelites have forgotten what God's done. And this is key for this morning. And this is actually something that I love, the Israelites are called to remember. I've had the chance to go to Israel like a couple times, three or four times. And one of the things you see, a reoccurring theme, and if you look in the Old Testament, you see Israel is walking with God. God blesses them. They're doing well. They kind of get comfortable, forget what he's done, and then they end up in trouble. They end up in sin, and they end up with enemies that are coming up against them. And one of the saying that they have in Israel is this, is remember, don't forget. Really simple. Remember, don't forget. It seems kind of redundant, but the idea is this, is that you need to remember and not forget, and remembering not just, okay, I remember this historical event, but actually more importantly of just like, remember who God is. Remember who he is in your life. Remember what he has done for you and keep that close. It's referring to Deuteronomy 8. And like I said, we're going to be reading a lot this morning. I actually want to read this just because it's a really powerful passage. This is Deuteronomy 8. Verses 10 through 18. And again, I'll give you a second to turn there. But this just talks about basically this warning that Israel had. Like I told you that Israel is at this place where they've forgotten who God is and they're serving these other idols. And they've got people who are entrusted with the ark who are not being faithful. And then you have this passage here from before where God is saying, hey, you know what? Remember, don't forget. Let's go ahead and read this together. It says, and you shall eat and be full, and you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land he has given you. Take care lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and rules and his statutes, which I command you today. Lest when you have eaten and are full and have built good houses and live in them, and when your herds and flocks multiply, and your silver and gold is multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, then your heart be lifted up and you forget the Lord your God. And so this idea of, you know, when things are going well, when you're successful, there's going to be this tendency to forget the Lord your God. So make sure you're giving him thanks and remembering. Continuing on in the second part of 14, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, and who led you through the great and terrifying wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water, who brought you water out of the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna that your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and test you to do you good in the end. Beware lest you say in your heart, my power and my might of my hand have gotten me this wealth. You shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may confirm his covenant that he swore to your fathers as it is this day. So there's just this powerful reminder of, you know, when things are going well, when you're successful, when you're in the promised land for a long time and you get comfortable, don't forget God. Don't forget what he's done for you. And kind of a real life example of this, your guys' students, the kids who live in this area, great kids, and you know, they love living here, but I would guess to say that they don't quite understand maybe what it's taken for you or your parents or just your family in general to get to a nice place like Carmel Valley, to live where you do, to have the privileges that they have. They don't understand necessarily the sacrifices that you have made. They love it. They, you know, they're grateful and they're thankful, but they're not the generation that has gone through and had to make those sacrifices. So there's not this same closeness, the same connection with the blessings and the things that you're able to experience here in Carmel Valley. So the same kind of idea of, you know, it's important that we pass that on to the next generation. It's important that for them, they need to remember, okay, you know what, like, we didn't just all of a sudden appear here. Someone worked really hard to get us here. And for Israel in this situation, it's God saying, you know what, remember that I'm the one who brought you this. And for us as well, it's remembering that God is the one who brought us this. So we see very clearly that God and his people are both really aware of how important it is to remember. But in the situation, it's clear that Israel has forgotten. But one of the things that I want to talk about that it's important for us and also that Israel did is they would set up standing stones. And if you go to Israel, you'll see different places where there's these giant rocks and things set up. And what they do is they'd set up stones to remind them of what God had done. Something significant would happen and they would set up a standing stone. And I told you we're going to get back to the story of Joshua and them crossing the Jordan. If you want to turn to, Joshua chapter 4, we're going to read a couple of verses there and just look at this idea of when God does something important, does something significant, why it's important to set up standing stones and remember. So starting in verse 1 of chapter 4. This is what it says. It says, when all the nation had finished passing over the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, take 12 men from the people, from each tribe a man, and command them, saying, take 12 stones from here out of the midst of the Jordan, from the very place where the priest's feet stood firmly, and bring them over with you and lay them down in the place where you lodge tonight. Then Joshua called the 12 men from the people of Israel, whom he had appointed, a man from each tribe. And Joshua said to them, pass on before the ark of the Lord your God into the midst of the Jordan, and take up each of you a stone upon his shoulder, according to the number of tribes of the people of Israel, that this may be a sign among you. When your children ask in time to come, what do those stones mean to you? Then you shall tell them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord when it passed over the Jordan. The waters of the Jordan were cut off, so these stones shall be to the people of Israel a memorial forever. So this cool idea of, you know, they cross the Jordan and basically Joshua tells them, you know, we're going to get some stones. We're going to set them up. And it's going to be this cool thing where when the kids walk by and they see these stones, they're going to be like, hey, mom, hey, dad, why are these stones here? What's the point of this? And it'll be this opportunity for them to talk and to share about what God has done, to be like, you know what, let me tell you, like, there was this cool time where we needed to cross this river. And, you know, God basically just said, you know what, take the ark, walk out. I'm going to lead you guys across. You're going to go on dry ground. And he stopped up the river and he delivered us through this. And so this idea of just setting up stones, setting up things that reminded them of who God is. And what we see very clearly, though, is that at this point in Israel, even though they'd only been in the promised land 200 to 300 years, they'd already gotten to a place where they had forgotten. We see that they have already started to serve other gods, and that the people who are entrusted with the ark are being unfaithful. What I find interesting, though, is if you look back at the passage, if you look at 1 Samuel 4, verses 7 and 8, you see that the Philistines, they seem to get it more than the Israelites do. When the Israelites are excited that the ark comes into the camp, but the Philistines right away are like, hey, you know what? We need to fight hard because these are the gods who delivered these people out of Egypt. This is the God who, like, brought in plagues and did all these terrible things. They know. They remember. They're like, you know what? We see this. This God is powerful. This God is mighty. We need to watch out. And so it's interesting to me that that Israel is, even though they're excited that the ark comes into the camp, they seem to remember less of who their God is than the Philistines do. And it kind of brings up this question of, you know, for Israel, if they, you know, why did they go into to the battle without consulting God in the first place, and why didn't they bring the ark? And what we see is that Israel is probably at this point doing everything without God. It's not just that they're fighting this battle. They're living their lives on their own. They're living their lives on their own strength. And then they come and they try to rely on the ark. But first of all, they're just trusting in their own strength. And then they bring in the ark, hoping that it will, you know, kind of change their luck and bring it around. Let's go on and move to the last point, and that is this, is that Israel has forgotten how to seek God. I talked about this already. We looked at Samuel 7, 3, where, you know, basically Samuel's telling Israel to put away the false gods from among them. But what we're seeing is that Israel at this point in time, what that would mean if they had these temples and these other gods would mean that they're actually seeking other gods as well. They're not relying fully on God. It means that they think that there's something that these other gods can give them that their God can't. So when they go into war, they're not doing like they did in the past, like Joshua and Moses did, and saying, you know, God, how are we to defeat this enemy? How are we to fight this battle? It just says they go right into battle. They don't consult and say, hey, should we go get the ark? They just go right ahead and grab the ark. They're doing things kind of in a panic, doing them on their own strength, and they're not seeking God. And it's interesting, back in that time, and we saw it with Joshua, and when they fight the Battle of Jericho, and basically God is giving him instruction. The prophet at the time is the people's line to God. Today, like, we are able to speak to God through the Holy Spirit because of what Christ has done for us. But back in those days, they had their prophet, and that was like their one line to God, where God would speak to the prophet, and then this prophet would speak to the people and lead them. And the people have forgotten that. They don't consult Samuel. They don't go to him and say, how would God, you know, have us fight this battle? So they don't seek God. They have other gods in their midst. They're not doing well. And as we move into kind of, okay, well, this is what they should have done. I want to make it really clear, though, that it's not like a list of actions or a prescribed thing that the people should do. There's not like, instead of Israel, just going on their own, they should go talk to Samuel first, check. They should go grab the ark, check. There's not like this list of things they should do. What the issue here is that their hearts are far from God. And that's what God cares about. It's not that they didn't go through the right order to engage in battle, but that the people, that their hearts themselves are far from God. This is actually talking about one of David's brothers, but in 1 Samuel 16, verse 7, it says this. It says, but the Lord said to Samuel, do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. And that's not talking to a people as a whole. That's talking about one specific person. But we see also in the New Testament, when Jesus is addressing the Pharisees, he calls them whitewashed tombs. He says, you know what? You guys are doing all the right things on the outside. You guys seem like you're like the most holy people, but inside you have dead men's bones, he basically says. He's like, you look all clean and neat on the outside, but inside your hearts are filthy. And so what's important is that God cares about the heart of his people. And at this time, the heart of his people are seeking idols. They're seeking basically gods that they think will deliver them and not seeking the one true God. So just kind of in a recap, so why didn't the ark work? Why didn't having God's presence bring good luck? And it's because God's presence isn't a good luck charm. Just having this box that is powerful, that is significant, that's not what delivers. Israel instead lost the battle because of the state of their hearts. They were sinful. They'd forgotten who their God was and what they had done for them, what he had done for them. And they forgot to follow his lead. And so this kind of brings me kind of in a transition point of what, you know, this is what Israel's issue was. This is what they were dealing with. They tried to use the ark as a good luck charm. It didn't work. The point I want to make is that there are no good luck charms. That God is not a good luck charm. Nothing else. There's no other like symbols or items that are good luck charms. It was interesting when I was preparing for this a couple weeks ago, I came across this article, and it was talking about how in Korea there's the College Scholastic Ability Test. And some of you guys may know of this, but it's this really important, really hard test that over 700,000 of the students in Korea need to take. And it basically, if you do well on this test, then your future is set. Like if you ace this test, it's like you're going to go to a good school, have a good job. Your life is going to be great. If you just do mediocre on the test, your life is not going to be so great. It's going to be a struggle. It's this big, big thing. In fact, it's so big that in the country, it's kind of crazy, they don't allow the military to fly jets over because they don't want the noise. They tell workers to come into work late so that way students can get to the testing. They do all sorts of things. They open the stock market later. They basically change the whole country on that one day for this 9-hour test. For this 9-hour test, so the students have like the ability to get there, do it. It all works well. It's like this really, really important day. And on that day, what mothers do of these students is they go to the temple, they go to church, and they pray for the entire 9 hours. They just spend the whole time either on their face or just like, you know, God let them pass or whoever they're praying to. And it's this really intense thing. And I look at that and I'm like, that's kind of intense. And even though it's not necessarily, it's not bad. Like, I'm sure when your kids have tests, you're like, God, please let them pass. But for them, it's like all 9 hours they do that and they think, okay, well, you know what? If I do this, then my student will pass. I've put in the time. I've been praying. And it's like almost this superstitious act. It becomes not just, okay, you know what? I'm going to seek God in this and, you know, pray and give it to him. It's no, if I do this, if I put in 9 hours, then God should owe me this because I've been really faithful in praying. So it's this idea of like almost a superstitious act in order to get their children to do well on this test. And I look at that, and I think that's crazy. But then I think, okay, well, actually, we do the same sort of thing all the time. In fact, 10 years ago, probably a little more than this now, a book that was really popular was The Prayer of Jabez. And I remember I went to work at a summer camp one summer, and they actually had a copy of it on my pillow. And I didn't really know what it was, but flipped through it and come to find, like, the whole idea with it. And it started out as actually a decent idea. But the idea was that if you pray this prayer, then God will expand your territory. He will give you wealth. He will provide for you. And it's like, all you need to do is pray this prayer every day and really believe it and claim it, that it's going to happen for you, that'll be true for you. And it's just like, now I look at that, I'm like, that seems ridiculous. But everyone was kind of into it for a while, and it just seems, I don't know, it just seems kind of crazy. But one of the things, as I was reading this and as I was preparing, I was like, you know what, I actually kind of do the same thing now. And when I prepare for this sermon this morning, like, I found myself over the last couple weeks, I'm like, okay, well, you know what, I need to put in this certain amount of time of prayer, I need to put in this certain amount of time of study. Like, I almost turned even just preparing for this message into that same thing where I'm like, you know what, God, if I work really hard on this, then you owe it to me that it's going to be a good sermon, people will laugh, people will learn a lot. Like, and I get this like mindset, whether it's subtle or not, where I think, if I do the right things, if I follow these steps, then things should go well, I should have good luck, that God should owe me. And it's ridiculous. And I think we do it with a lot of things. In fact, we do it with things that are not necessarily even bad things. We do it with physical objects where you have like, okay, I've got my lucky cross necklace or something like that. But also with things like going to church or praying or working in youth ministry. Like, you take things and you're like, okay, you know what? God, if I just go to church enough, if I'm just regularly going to church, then you should be blessing my marriage because, you know what, like, I'm seeking after you, and you know what, you owe it to me because I'm following you with my whole heart. So why isn't my marriage working out? I'm going to church, I'm praying, I'm doing all these things. And we get this idea of, okay, well, God should owe us. Same thing with like children. If, you know, you want your kids to be smart, you want them to be godly, you want them to do well. And so it's like, okay, well, you know what, God, because, you know, I've followed all these things. I'm part of this women's group or this father's group that like meets and we talk about you. And so, you know what? My kids should be doing well because I'm seeking after you or whatever. Like, we get this idea that because we do something, it's like a rabbit's foot or like a Coke machine. Like, God, we're doing this. We're putting in the money. You should probably give me this Coke. Like, this idea of I'm doing X and then you need to give me Y. And I think it happens really subtly. It's not something that is necessarily obvious all the time. It actually usually happens with things that are good things. Maybe it's like, it's something that you're doing that's good. And I'm not saying to stop praying or stop going to church, but when we take those things and we think, okay, well, because I'm doing this, my life is balanced. God, now you should be giving me, you know, things in return. And so we get into that mindset really subtly. And it's important to remember, it's important for us to remember that God, he's the creator of everything. He's the creator of the universe. He's given us everything. And it's not that he was created to do our will and to do the things that we want. In Hawaii, there's this brand, and some of our students have it. It's this, he is greater than I. And you'll see it on a t-shirt. It's like the he, and then the greater sign, and then an I. And the idea is this. It's really simple. It's just reminding you constantly that God is bigger than you, that God is more powerful than you, more important than you. And it's humbling, but it's also comforting because it's like, you know what? God is powerful. He is in control. He's bigger than my circumstances. So there's this, both this reminder of, okay, you know what? God is amazing. He's the creator of all the planets, all the stars, the universe. But also this reminder of, he's that awesome, but he also loves us. It's a cool two-way reminder thing. I love it. So I guess with this, so we shouldn't look at God as a good luck charm. How are we supposed to respond to this? How are we supposed to live in light of this? And I think it's important for us to realize, like, when it's not working, or I guess realize for us, like, that we do look at God as a good luck charm. Realize in your life, like, think about now even, like, the ways that maybe you are praying or going to church and thinking, well, because I'm doing this, God, you should be doing something for me. And it's frustrating because right now you might even be in a place where you're like, I'm working really hard. I'm doing a lot of things and I'm not seeing results from it. Like, God, I'm holding up my end of the bargain, but where are you? Like, where are you in all of this? I'm working really hard. And you're not doing what I want you to do, basically. You're like, I'm doing all these right things, but yet my family is struggling right now. Things are hard. And what I want to challenge you with, and this is the same thing that was happening with Israel, is that they have forgotten. And what they've forgotten this, and this is a really, it's like a challenge, but it's also cool because it's not a, like, you need to try harder. It's this, is that what we forget as Christians, I talked about context. When you look at the context of that story, Israel was, you know, worshiping other gods and that sort of thing. When you look at the context of the whole Bible in our life, the big picture is this, is that Christ died for us, that Christ took away our sins, that Christ came and suffered. We sang a lot of awesome songs this morning just talking about how basically he came down and he took the guilt away, that we don't need to live in guilt and shame anymore because of what Christ has done. And even the songs are awesome because they're talking about reminding us of that. And what we need to do is realize this, is that Christ came, he suffered, he died the death we should have died, and paid the price that we could not pay. And we need to keep that close. We need to remember that. We need to remember the big picture when the mountains are, we're in the mountains or we're in the low. That was one of the songs that we were singing that was awesome. Just like, you know, in the highs and the lows, God, you are still faithful. You are good. And what it is when we remember that, when we constantly are doing exchange with the gospel, and what I mean by that is when we're constantly remembering what Christ did for us, then we are able to live a life of victory in spite of our circumstances. And it's hard. It doesn't necessarily change what's going on, but what it allows you to do is it allows that thing, whatever it is you're really hoping for, whatever it is that you're trying to get good luck in, it takes the power of that away. It makes it so God is able to free you from that because you're able to see, look, you know what? I may be stressing out about this situation, and they're big. It's whether it's, you know, something, there's an issue with your family, an issue with your job, whatever it is. It's a real thing. It's a big thing. But God is saying, you know what? Look, remember, don't forget. Remember what I did for you on the cross, and focus and live in light of that. And it's hard because it's remembering that God died on our behalf. It's remembering that he's the one who fought on the cross, that it's not something that we do, but it's something that he has already done for us. The key to this is to basically... And not to give you guys like steps, but it's that we need to have our heart attuned to God, that we need to be seeking after him and realizing what he has done for us. And there's a couple of verses that are really cool that kind of point this out and emphasize this. The first one is Exodus 14:14. It says, "The Lord will fight for you. You need only be still." And then Psalm 46:10, "Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth." And again, just kind of this idea that it's not about trying harder. It's not about doing more things so that way you build up this credit with God so he owes you. It's remembering that God has already sent his son to die for you, that the work has already been done. So it's remembering what has happened, what has already been done, and living in light of that. There's one more thing I want to say with this too, is that when we do this, when we stop walking with God, when our heart is not in tune with God, what happens isn't that we turn away completely. It's not like all of a sudden you're like, well, I'm completely off. I'm not going to church. I'm not doing, you know, I'm not seeking after God. Israel, when they fought this battle, they didn't forget God completely. In fact, it says in the first verse there, the verse 3 of that passage, it says basically that when they're defeated by the Philistines, that Israel says, why has the Lord defeated us through the Philistines today? They even acknowledge, like, God is the one who allowed this to happen. And I think the point that I want to make there with that is, for us, a lot of times it's not that we are like going from worshiping God in church to like serving some other random idol even. It's just that we've allowed part of our heart to seek after something else, to trust in something else. When I was just talking a second ago about looking to the gospel and remembering what Christ has done and putting our hope in that, what we end up doing is we take other little things, whether it's being successful in a job or whatever it is, or that our hope is in, thinking, okay, you know what, if I can only have this, if I only can make it in this career, if I can only have this family, that's my ideal. We put our hope in something else that isn't God. And we do it subtly. It's not, again, like we turn away and start worshiping some other idol. What I want to do is kind of give you guys some things like how do we do this? How do we tune our heart to God without being like, okay, well, here's just religious steps for you to take. Here's just, you know, 3 points for you to do, and then you've got it. But it is, even though those can become idols, it is important to have a plan. It is important to know how you're going to, like right now, if you have things that you're seeking after more than God, how to seek after God. And the first thing is this is, and this is obvious, is like the church thing, spend time with God. And what I mean by that is don't just be like, okay, well, I'm going to set my timer and I've got 30 minutes that I'm reading my Bible. I mean, actually spend time with God. And even that idea of being still, like sit before God. Like if you're in any other relationship, whether it's a marriage or a dating relationship, in order to know that person, you need to actually just spend time with them, talking to them, listening to them. And that's what God wants. God wants you to be focused on him. He wants you to understand and have a deep understanding of the love that he has for you, of what he's done for you in Christ. Also is this is the next thing that we can do is we can learn God's laws. And that may at first seem like, wait, you want me to like learn a bunch of rules? But really the idea is this is that God set up, God gives his laws because he knows that they're what's best for us. Kind of a cool point is that when Israel receives the Ten Commandments even, Jesus had delivered them already and then gave them the laws. He didn't say, here, follow these laws, do these things, and I will deliver you. And I think sometimes we get that switched. We think, oh, we got to do all these things. We got to be really moral people, and then God will love us, and he will bless us. But the idea is this, is that in order to attune your heart to God, be familiar, understand his laws, and take delight in those, because he gave them to us for our own good. The other thing is this is create standing stones, create your own standing stones. And I don't mean to, go out in your front yard and put up some big rocks. That'd be kind of ridiculous. But you can if you want to. But the idea is this is set up things that remind you of what God has done in your life. Maybe it's even family traditions. There's a pastor that I know, who him and his family, like every Friday night, they have like a Shabbat, a little like kind of Sabbath night, and their family gets together and they hang out and they just talk about and remember the things that God is doing in their life. And so set up things that remind you, set up things that, you know, if God has worked a mighty way in the life of your family, make that something that is able for your kids to see and be like, hey, what was this about? And then you can be like, let me tell you what God did here in our lives, like what God did for our family. And so it's important for us to set up things that remind us of God's goodness. And so with that, though, I want to tell you, and I think I kind of said this a little bit, but when we do this, when we switch from saying, you know what, God, instead of doing all these things, instead of trying to find this good luck charm, instead I'm just going to attune my heart to you and basically allow the fact that you love me so much that you sent your son to die for me, I'm going to let that become so real that it changes my perspective, that it changes the way I live. Let me tell you, with that, it's hard, especially for us as Americans. We like to do, and there is still doing. There's stuff that needs to be done, but it's hard to just sit back and say, you know what, God, you've already done this for me. It's kind of a blow to your pride in a sense too, because it's like, you know what, like this isn't something I've done. I can't say, look at this accomplishment. I'm really close to God. Like I've worked really hard at this and now I'm close to God. It's no, you just sit before God and say, God, draw near to me. I will listen. I'm being still before you. And you give that glory and that to God instead of allowing your own pride to build with that. The other thing is this, is that having a heart attuned to God, having an understanding of that, it doesn't mean necessarily worldly blessings. It doesn't mean the type of good luck that maybe you're hoping for or expecting. But let me tell you this. If you look at the life of Paul in the New Testament, Paul was a person who went through jail. He went through beatings. He basically didn't live what I would consider to be an ideal life. But yet through all of it, he was joyful. His perspective was, you know, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. He had this hope and this joy that I think is just, I don't know, it's beyond anything that having a worldly success or worldly blessings even compares to. His perspective was so in tune with what God had done and with what Christ had done. That was so real to him that he had joy despite any of his circumstances. So again, it's not that the blessings, like having a heart attuned to God, is going to give you blessings or wealth or anything like that. Don't hear me saying that. But yeah, so in closing, kind of big picture with all of this. It's this idea of remember, don't forget. When we look at that story of Israel, the key there is that they had forgotten. They had forgotten who God was, and so they tried to bring in this luck charm of the ark to change their fate, and it didn't work out. Instead, what the people needed to do and what we need to do is be still before God, to express a gratitude for what he's done, to make real in our own lives, in our own hearts, what he has done for us already. So kind of in summary, God does not bring good luck. But the thing is that true life is found when we live in light of the gospel. And And the thing is, when we have that, when we have that true life, it's better than luck. It's better than having things go in our way in a specific circumstance, because our heart is attuned to God. The gospel is real to us. And so my hope for you guys as you guys leave today, and kind of just a challenge, is as you guys get in your cars and you go home, instead of flipping on the radio and, you know, going about the rest of your day, going to lunch, maybe take a minute and just spend some time with God and say, God, like, here I am. Like, show me who you are. Make the gospel, make your love for me real to me. And I pray and I hope that that would be something that we're challenged with, that we wouldn't be like Israel who forgets, but that we would be a people that, instead of turning to good luck charms, instead of trying to find ways to manipulate God, instead that we would be the type of people who constantly remember his goodness, who constantly remember what he's done for us in Christ and the gospel, and that that would change us. Let me pray for us. God, thank you for this morning. And I pray that through all the stuff we went through and all the words that were said, God, I pray that one thing would come out clear, God, and that it is that it is important for us to remember you and your goodness and the gospel, God. And that I pray that for us, that that would be something that if maybe we've been seeking after other things, if we've been distracted, God, that you would make the gospel clear and real, and not just a remember of, okay, we know the historical facts of Christ dying on the cross, but God, that you would help us in our heart to remember, to truly remember and to truly respond to the fact that you love us so much, that your son died for us and went through separation from you, went through pain and suffering and rejection, God, from those closest to him, so that way we could be close to you, God. And I just pray that you'd make that real to us, and God, that just the power of that would sink in, that we would remember, that we wouldn't forget, God. We give you this morning. We just pray that you're glorified in it. Pray these things in your son's name.